Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi everyone, and welcome to Confessions of a Debut Novelist, with me, your host, Chloe Timms. This week, I'm talking to Alice Bell about her crime novel, Grave Expectations. Alice grew up in southwest England, and she now lives in Cork, Ireland. In 2018, Alice became the deputy editor of Rock Paper Shotgun, a popular PC gaming website, and in 2019, she was named one of the 100 most influential women in the UK games industry. In this episode, we discuss how she created her crime-solving duo of a medium and a teenage ghost, how Alice works out who done it and why, then works backwards, and why, now that she's published, bookshops have become a place of fear. But first, here's Alice with an excerpt from Grave Expectations.
"You don't look like a medium," said Alex, passing the joint again. Emboldened by the positive reception, Claire took a healthier pull this time and spent a few moments looking up at the sky. It had become a very clear night, and this far from the city she could see all the stars scattered everywhere, like broken glass in a pub car park. "I don't know," she said after a bit. "What are mediums supposed to look like?" "Yeah, all right, fair enough. Do you have a spirit guide?" "Yep, I do." Basher snorted at this. "I do, though," Claire protested. "Yes," Basher said. "I expect he's some Native American chieftain or a poor Victorian shoeshine boy." "No, actually," said Claire, who was feeling the effects of what was really very good quality weed. "Nah, I don't know if I should tell you." "You know you have to now," cried Alex. "Yeah, go on, it'll freak him out," said Sophie. Okay, she's a girl, in fact." Yes, said Basher, "with long dark hair, and she's going to crawl out of the TV." "That's a whole other thing, that's a movie, that's not real, duh," Claire replied. "Of course, I apologise. So what is your ghost's tragic backstory? A Georgian waif who died at Christmas, a poor misfortunate who pined to death in the 50s? "Don't be boring, Uncle B," said Alex. "You sound like Dad when you get all smug." "She's not a Victorian waif," said Claire, who was starting to get a bit annoyed by Basher and was keen to prove him wrong. "She's from the noughties. She died when she was 17. Very convenient," said Basher. "No historical research required with a ghost from your own generation." "Well, joke's on you, because I studied history, so if I wanted to make up a period-accurate ghost, I could, but I don't need to," said Claire. She was trying to freak them out a bit, but it wasn't really working. Sophie rolled her eyes. Claire looked up at the diamond sky again and started laughing. "It's funny. She's not anything. She's just normal, really." "I'm not weirdo," said Sophie. "I'm exceptional." "She's annoying," Claire corrected. She looked over the flames at her friend, bright-eyed and smirking, standing in the clothes she had been murdered in. "Her name's Sophie, and she's been eavesdropping on you for like half an hour already."
Hi, Alice. Welcome to the podcast. I'm really excited to have you on with me today to discuss your debut novel, Grave Expectations.
Thank you so much for having me. I love a podcast. I'm excited to be here. Happy to chat.
So can you start by telling us what Grave Expectations is about?
Yes, I will try my best because I always struggle with this. I start to basically do the plot of the whole book and then I go, oh no, I want you to read it. So Grave Expectations is about a very reluctant medium called Claire, who is employed. She's sort of like a kind of freelance medium struggling to get work. She's not a very good medium because she can actually see ghosts, but she's not great at doing the whole pomp and circumstance of it. So she goes to a crumbling old English home manor and she meets the ghost of a recent murder victim, but she can't tell who it is or why they were murdered or kind of even when. But with the help of two of the least objectionable members of the Wellington Forge family who live in the mansion, and the extra help of her best friend Sophie, who is herself a ghost and has been stuck as a 17-year-old for the last 30 odd years, they figure out who done it and why and who they done it to.
And I loved the idea of Sophie being a ghost. I just thought that was such a great idea. I wondered, actually, when I was reading it, I was like, was there a temptation for you to kind of leave Sophie's ghostness a secret, you know, do it like a Bruce Willis in Sixth Sense? Or did, you know, were you always going to reveal it like quite early on?
Do you know, I thought about it. I think because the longer you can leave something before a payoff, kind of the more of a whammo it is, isn't it? But I thought, I don't think I'm really good enough to done it for as long. And do you know, because it's revealed at the end of the first chapter, and I was hoping there'd be a way to not mention it on the you know, on the back of the book almost, so that people don't know. But it is kind of the USP of the book almost, if we can talk about art having a USP. But I think it's important to me because I do want it to be a thing that she, you know, she's always been 17, because I've said before, it's a deeply unserious book, Great Expectation, but I have thought quite a lot about the theming of it in a way. And so you know, Claire is a millennial, and the millennial condition is to always be thought of as a child, you know, as a whiny teenager. And despite the fact that, you know, depending on where you put the barriers, like millennials have mortgages and they're pushing 40, and, you know, and so Sophie, because she died when she was 17, is a millennial who is literally always stuck as a teenager, you know, and that's sort of representing, you know, that stopped Claire developing a bit as well. So I don't think, I would have loved to manage it, but I did think about it, but I don't think I could really have gotten away with it. I'd have forgotten. Oh, she walked through a wall. Ah, you know.
Yeah, you would have had readers like scratching their head being like, how is this logical for a person? I didn't read the back of the book, so it was a nice surprise for me anyway. Ooh. But I actually agree with you, like, it's a perfect hook. I mean, that's like you were saying about, you know, art having USP. We all unfortunately kind of have to think about that aspect of it, because, you know, how is your book going to stand out? You need something that's a bit different. But that aspect in your novel was so much fun. Like, I really enjoyed Sophie and Sophie and Claire's dynamic. Tell us a little bit more about Claire then. She's described in the book as in the blurb as a burnt out millennial medium. How did you kind of like develop her character? Like, where did she start? Did the book start with her, or did she come from the kind of writing process?
So she developed as part of the writing process, because I sort of thought about when I was coming up with the idea for the book, I wanted to do a sort of detective and psychic that were, you know, a live person and ghost, like a Randall and Hopkirk deceased sort of a thing. I wanted as well to have a detective who wasn't competent. Like, because I love all kinds of detective fiction, but I been on a tear when I was writing the book of reading, you know, it was always those like male detectives who were brilliant but troubled, and they were married once but their marriage broke down because they're an alcoholic, and
I was gonna say they always have a drinking problem, and it's always like they're coming back to do that one last job and then they get into staying forever.
Exactly. And so I wanted someone who was who sort of thought like they could solve a murder because they watched a lot of like TV, because I think that's at least speaking for myself, you know, that's kind of how I feel. I've watched every episode of Criminal Minds. I could catch a serial killer, but in practice obviously would not be able to do it that easily. And so I was thinking about, well, it can't be a, you know, a police detective. So what sort of person, if you could see a ghost, how would that affect your life? And if you could see all ghosts, because Claire can see all dead people, and it's wildly inconvenient for her, and it makes her, you know, it's difficult for her to have and keep friends because she's a bit weird, and like if you don't believe in ghosts, she's just always talking to thin air. And also if you don't believe in ghosts, then it seems like she's, you know, making stuff up. So she has sort of settled into the path of least resistance, which is being a medium for hire, but she's also not very good at it because she doesn't dress all mysteriously and she doesn't wear a lot of, you know, dark eyeliner, and she's just sort of a bit rubbish at it. And so she's not making a lot of money, and she's, you know, struggling to get work, and she's just tired all the time. And, you know, she's tried working with the police before and that's not what turned out very well. So it was, working backwards from the idea of if you could see ghosts and there was one next to you all the time, in what ways would that affect how you had to live your life, you know?
So I'm wondering then, where did the kind of idea of this novel begin? I think I'm right in saying it was a bit of a lockdown fun project for you. So where did you always have this kind of idea that you wanted to write this book, or did it come as a surprise to you that you just started writing it? Tell us about the kind of the initial moment where you started writing.
It was a lockdown baby. And I, like everyone who studied English at university, I've always been a struggling novelist, i.e. have not been published or finished a book. So this is the first book that I've finished. I've written projects that I've nearly finished, and I'm a writer in my day job. I'm like a pop culture video game journalist. So this was, while we were all trapped inside, I was reading a lot of detective fiction, and I was reading a lot of, indie detective fiction. And I just thought it would be fun to kind of, because I like writing, to just do like a fun project that I didn't have any pressure on it. I was never intending to finish it or send it off. And because I didn't put that kind of pressure on myself, I was sort of, I did finish it because I wasn't worrying about it. You know, I was just having fun with it. But I was sort of almost perversely, I was like looking at all the stuff I'd been reading, and I had been reading a lot of like horrible serial killer, which also I love. Like I'm, you know, it's a Broadchurch crime fiction. I like all of it, but a lot of horrible serial killers that, you know, kidnap women and staple their tongues to their foreheads and all that kind of stuff. So I wanted something that wasn't that grim, that was a bit fun and was funny in the way that real life is funny. And I was like, okay, what combination of like, what detective team can I put together that is like representative of what I find cozy and, you know, my life, but also is sort of, perversely unlike all the stuff I've read at the moment. So what's the opposite of like, the alcoholic, troubled, but brilliant maverick detective and his, you know, faithful Watson. And so I've got a bit of a ragtag bunch of a dead teenager and a medium and an artist and a depressed ex-cop. So.
Did you have in your mind, I want to write a crime book, or I want to write something funny? I know obviously you were inspired by detective fiction, but I'm wondering whether, I'm guessing you didn't kind of take it like seriously as in this is a serious crime book, but took it as a, this is going to be exactly what I feel like writing and what I would love to read. So did you just, and what I'm trying to say is, are you naturally funny, Alice? I didn't work at it.
Oh, it's awful to say, like, I think I'm hilarious. it was very much a case of, yeah, I wanted to write what I wanted to read. And because I had been reading all this grim, you know, serious stuff, I wanted something a bit lighter. But there is a lot of great cozy crime. I always shout out Mia Fee Mananzala. She's written some really nice modern cozy crime that isn't sort of twee. But I've been reading a lot of the twee stuff, so I wanted something a bit, say edgier, but like Grave Expectations is very kind of sweary, and there's a lot of like falling over and getting stuff wrong and kicking things. And but I do, because I work writing about video games, I kind of have to have fun and make jokes and stuff in my day job anyway. And so I think I would struggle to write something that was entirely serious, I think, which I would like to try one day. But yeah, like I said, I think I didn't want to write a parody, but real life is funny all the time. You know, stupid stuff happens to everyone. And I just sort of wanted it to be a bit like that.
Mm. Particularly your dialogue is great. I mean, that is like where a lot of the humour comes into it. Is that something, I mean, there's such a rhythm to it. Do you feel like your dialogue is something that kind of comes quite easy to you, or do you have to kind of work at it, kind of, I don't know, workshop it, read it aloud? What do you do to kind of get the dialogue right?
It's all of a bit of both, actually, because I do, when I'm writing dialogue, I try and think of how people talk in real, so I'm less concerned with being absolutely correct in terms of the grammar or the use of words. Do you know, I think a lot of times in the book I'll use word, like people will say whatchamacallit, or you know, that thing, because maybe they won't know, you know, real people won't necessarily know what a specific thing is, and they'll use words like that. And I think you can tell when, if you hear something in a film or on a TV show, you can just sort of tell if it's not something a person would say in real life, you know. But at the same time, I also, like, every time I've edited and gone back through, I've tweaked the dialogue a little bit. One thing that I did consciously do was I will try and find it and send the link to you, but I read a long time ago, I read a blog about Kevin Smith's films and his dialogue. And it's basically demonstrating that every character in the Kevin Smith film talks the same. Like, none of them have their own idiosyncrasies. So this blog post was saying it's good if you can take away the dialogue tags and the markers that say, like, you know, Claire said and Basha said, and you can still tell that it's how many people having the conversation. So the characters do all have, if you bother to pay attention and read really closely, they do all have little things that they all do. So Sophie is the most obvious. She says, oh my God, and LOL, because she's a teenager. Claire says, she says a lot, except when she's talking to Sophie. I just said, Basha doesn't use contractions very much at all. And Alex, who's the other, Alex is their Zoomer, they ask rhetorical questions quite a lot, things like that. So there are little, and that helps me writing it as well, because I know, you know, it gets you in the sort of zone of that character a bit, I find myself.
Yeah, that's such great advice. I mean, I've heard the thing about taking away the dialogue tags before, and certainly I've read books or texts before where you cannot tell who's talking.
Yeah,
you know, I it's a hard thing. Dialogue's difficult, but
yeah,
I think if you in their head your character starts to sound the same, then that's when you know you're in trouble.
Yeah, I don't think you need to do it. I wouldn't suggest going overboard and doing it with like every incident. Like if they go and buy an ice cream, the ice cream character doesn't have to have some kind of peculiar verbal, you know, habit or anything. But I think it does help if your main characters have like some distinction between them.
Mm. Especially when, I mean, particularly in your book, you've got a lot of group scenes. So I think you need that distinction as well. Tell us then a little bit more about some of your other characters. I mean, who was your favourite to write and why?
I do like writing Sophie because she's quite mean. So it's quite fun to insult people, and nobody can hear her except Claire, so she can be mean with impunity. My favorite though is probably, so I've said before, like the self-insert character is Basher, who's the depressed ex-cop who reads a lot, and you know, he's more of the obvious self-insert for me, I think. But my favorite to write is probably Alex, who's the fourth member of the little Scooby gang. And they are they're 19 and they're very confident and self-assured, and they're really fit, and they'll attack anything, they'll do anything, have a go at anything. And that's so kind of unlike me. It's just really kind of fun and freeing to write that sort of person. I suppose the other one as well that I really liked writing was Hugh, who is the patriarch of the posh family, and he's just quite a fun character of a big posh weirdo.
I always think the characters that are probably most fun to write are the ones that are so far removed from you. I mean, I know you said you enjoy kind of writing Basher. Basher's slightly like you in your mind. But I think, you know, I think the characters where you have to, you get to play around a bit more and be so different. I mean, that's the joy of writing, is just, I mean, I've always said that my favorite character to write in my book is like the most villainous character, because he's so despicable. I love writing him, like, because not me, you know. Right. And you can really push it, you know, you can push it in the, well, like you were saying with Alex's dialogue, they're kind of sarky and a little bit, you know, spiky and cynical sometimes. And that's fun to write. Like with Sophie, the being mean thing is fun because you have that freedom to be like, well, Sophie would say this, that's fine.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, sometimes that readers sort of think that when you write a bad character, you're endorsing everything they do, or even a good character. Like, good characters can do bad things and have flaws and stuff. You know, the quote unquote hero of your book can do bad things. And that, I think that's all just, you know, it's the rich tapestry of life, isn't it? And it's fun being able to explore all that as a writer. Yeah. And it's not necessarily like an endorsement that you should die and be a mean teenage ghost.
So I always have this image in my mind, and particularly when I'm reading novels that are crime novels that have to have, you know, twists and red herrings and things, I have this image of writers who write crime as being very thorough and having all these amazing plots and charts, and, you know, and then I speak to a lot of crime writers and they're like, nope, that's not me. I have no plan. So Alice, are you a chart person, a plan person? What's your kind of, you know, what's your method for plotting, or do you not plot?
I plot a bit, so I know who done it and why, and then I sort of work backwards from that and then plat kind of red herrings and other clues and stuff around that. And I tend to have key scenes that I then sort of improv my way to, like stepping stones, you know, for finishing the book. I do then afterwards, I'll read the draft and then I'll go through and I'll make quite a, I'll draw out by hand, like on graph paper, a checkbox tick list of stuff that I need to go back and add. And I find it very satisfying ticking all those off in order, but I am not very organized at all.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
And do you write chronologically? Or I mean, I'm guessing if you're going back and adding things, you can kind of almost do it like a backwards edit. But do you write scenes, you know, that you want to write and you enjoy, you know, you kind of think in your head, this is going to be a fun scene to write, I'll write this. Or do you sit there and go, I'm going to write chapter one, chapter two in order? How do you kind of work all that out?
I have to do it in order, because that's the only way that my brain can sort of process it. And I think also, if I just did the scenes I was looking forward to, I would not write any of the other bit. Like, I have to eat my broccoli before I can have the chocolate cake, you know. So I write a first draft, and then go back and sort of, not even like working backwards really, I write a first draft, look at it, work backwards in terms of like what I need to add, and then go through it from start to finish in order again, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. But I have to do it chronologically, because my brain could not handle it if I was jumping around. I just lose track of every single thing. Yeah,
I do. You know what, I've always said the same, and I think it's because I'm like, in my head, how can I know what the character is feeling if I'm writing something in chapter seven when I haven't written chapter three yet? But then actually recently I have been kind of trying to write more like by whim, and that is actually more fun. So even though maybe it's not the, I don't know, I think sometimes I think you've got to have a go with both sometimes. But tell us a little bit more about your kind of general writing routine, and what are the things that you really love writing about, or not, like, you know, what do you enjoy? The kind of idea stage, do you hate that stage, do you hate writing, I don't know, descriptive scenes? What are your kind of loves and hates of writing?
I love the idea stage, because everything is perfect at the idea stage. Because it's not like, the idea stage does not survive contact with air, you know. The idea stage is great. Everything is amazing. It's brilliant. You have all these amazing, it's all fizzing. It's going to be perfect. And then we have to pin it down on paper. Then it sort of dissolves a little bit, and all the kind of practicalities of it come in. So the idea stage is absolutely my favorite stage of writing. The most difficult bit for me is, because I have to go in order, if I get stuck on like it's usually when I know, okay, so they're in the kitchen now and they're having this conversation about this, and then I need to transition them so that, you know, she has a reason, Claire has a reason to be upstairs talking to this other person, and it's getting from A to B. Mm-hmm. Is usually that sort of transition where I get stuck, and because I have to go in order, I can be bashing my head against that for a long time. And it gets pretty kind of disheartening sometimes, because I have a job, like a 9-to-5, I write in the evenings, and and I forget sometimes that, like, the first draft doesn't have to be great. You just need to, like, she can just, for this first draft, you can just write, she went upstairs for some reason, you know, and then go back and fix it later. So sometimes I really struggle with that. So not even writer's block, really, just sort of running up against myself. Really struggle with.
The only issue you have when you do that is then when you go come back to it, then you go, you know, you look at the brackets that say, put in a reason here for Claire. And then you end up hating your former self for leaving those notes, which are like, I have no idea.
Yeah. But currently I am their former self. So anything I don't do is future Alice's problem. Yeah. She's a whole different person.
Yeah, you don't care about her.
Exactly.
So tell us how you came to get your agent and book deal then, because obviously you said this was just like a fun project you were doing in your spare time, and you didn't really necessarily have an intention to send it out, but then what was the point that you decided, yeah, this has got potential, and how did you go about it?
I think it was the point when I looked around and I was like, oh, I finished it, and it's, you know, 85,000 words long. I'd accidentally written the whole book, you know, and then I thought, well, I didn't intend to finish it or send it out, so in a way I've lost nothing if I send it out and no one cares, you know. And it was, but then of course it was immediately very fraught. So I basically had finished it, and then so I sent it to some beef readers, like my editor from work, who I trust to tell me when my writing is rubbish, and some other friends, and then did a couple more drafts, polished up the first 50 pages, which is what they always ask for, and just sent it off for a load of places. And I got a lot of rejections. I got a couple of requests, but mostly rejections, as everyone does. But then got a request from Steve Finnegan at Zeno Agency, and she was immediately, you know, really got it and was on board, and it was a good fit as an agency because they're a bit, you know, bit genre-y, and mine's a bit genre-y, and, you know, it's a tough one to pigeonhole. But it's really tough. Like, the worst bit for me, I think, was submission to agents, because you're waiting, you know, and you can't do anything, and you're waiting in a different way to when you're waiting when you're out on subs to publishers. So that was a tough one, but I was lucky, I think, in that the rejections I got were sort of encouraging rejections, you know. And I was also very lucky in that I didn't have to redraft it, but it was just a lot of hitting send and hope, you know.
Mm. What can you remember the kind of time scale of, you know, the point where you'd said, I'm finished, you sent it to beta readers, when you kind of started sending it out, to then when you signed with your agent? Was it quite a big gap?
I've written it down in notes on my so I was out, I was on query at the end of January 2021, and I went out on sub at the end of 2021. So I haven't written down when I got picked up by my agency, and I haven't written down when I finished the book, which is not helpful. I think it was about, I want to say like 8 months or something to get an agent, which again is super lucky. And I think one thing I would say is that, again, like my journey to being a published author has included like a decade of being a writer already, albeit in a different form. And I have so much respect for people who just, you know, they want to write a book, and they write a book, and they haven't worked writing anywhere else, and they haven't been edited before, and they just do this whole thing. It's such a difficult process for anyone. And I'm just very lucky to have had a bit of sort of experience kind of adjacently anyway.
Mm-hmm. And the reason I ask about the sort of timings, I think, is because, again, A, it varies. B, when you enter into that moment of querying, I mean, I speak as someone who didn't do it, so I can't speak from experience, but from what I've heard, you know, it could be days, it could be weeks, it could be months. And there really is no, you know, definite way of getting an agent. And I think I kind of find that slightly reassuring in a weird way, because I think if it was that thing of, well, if you haven't heard within 3 weeks, your dream is over. Like, I don't, you know, that isn't the case. I spoke to someone whose query went in an agent's spam folder, and they only discovered it when the agent went and looked at their spam. So
that's amazing.
So it can be, you know, it can be really weird circumstances like that that end up giving you the agent. And then of course, after you've got the agent, you then have to go on sub.
Yeah.
Which for me was the worst part. How was your kind of, what was that like for you? Because your book sold in the States as well. So which deal came first? Was it the UK one or the States?
It was actually the audiobook deal that came first.
Oh, wow,
I think.
Okay. I've never heard that before.
I think. I'm not entirely sure of the timing of it, but do you know what? It might not have been. I think it was, the audiobook was like a couple of days after, but it was a preempt, which is exciting. Because I had no idea how this, I thought it worked how freelance pitching works in my world, which is that as a freelancer, you'll have an idea for an article and you'll send it to an editor on a website, and they'll read it and they'll say, oh yes please, I would like to commission this, or no thank you. And then if they say no thank you, then you take it to a different person. So I thought that was kind of how it worked. I thought that like Stevie would go to Penguin and be like, hey Penguin, and then they'd say no, so she went down the list. So I didn't realize it was, you just send it to everyone and then try and initiate sort of a bidding war, I guess. So I was really surprised by that. And it was exciting to get a preempt from Corvus, which is Crime Imprint of Atlantic. So that's the UK deal went first. And that was quite frantic because I was at work and Stevie was like calling me and stuff. And then because of that deal, it was easier to kind of get a deal to match it in the US. In the US, it's Knopf, which is a PRH subsidiary, words are hard to say. But that's paperback only, so it's a bit of a different situation to the UK deal, which is hardback and then paperback and the whole thing. But one of the other thing that I didn't expect I would have to do is Stevie got me to write up synopses for like 5 ideas, you know, for sequels in a series, and they got sent up as well. So the first deal was a 2-book deal. So I've been doing the sequel. And it's all just new stuff that, you know, like nobody tells you how this works until it's happening. And one of the things that I've been doing sort of along the way is I just email Stevie all the time and say, like, is this good? I don't know if this is good. what does this mean? Is this how this normally works?
My one bit of advice for anyone who is going on sub would be have some other ideas in your head, because you're bound to be asked, like, what's your next book going to be? And don't have the answer like I had, which was, I have no clue, and now I have 15 minutes to kind of come up with some other novel ideas. That is the one single way to evaporate any creativity in your brain, so don't do that.
I think important as well is that, like, it does feel like you have to take whatever deal is off to you or whatever agent is talking to you, because you sort of feel like, oh, I might not get another chance. But in the meetings you have with, because, you know, there are horror stories of people that sign on to different publishers and have terrible experiences, or agents and have terrible experiences. And I think it's important to treat the meetings you have with prospective agents or publishers as like, that's a chance for you to sort of ask them, you know, where do they see themselves, you know, pitching this book? If you're talking to an agent, like, where would you, you know, sub? What would be good publishers, do you think? You can ask publishers how they would market the book, where they would see it on the shelf, that sort of thing, because you also want to be somewhere where your book will be a good fit and be valued. So you can sort of take control for part of that meeting as well, you know.
Yeah, it's always a weird dynamic, isn't it? Because it almost feels like, I mean, sometimes it feels like your agent is your boss, and then actually you have to remind yourself that, you know, like, they're there to be your biggest champion. And
yeah.
So, I mean, I remember meetings with my editor and also my agent where, you know, they're almost pitching to you. It's a very, it's a very weird thing.
I think it's easy to forget that, like, you're the moneymaker. Maybe you're the golden goose, right? you need to be with people that want you to be a success, because otherwise what's the point, right?
Yeah, definitely. So one of the things I would love to talk to you about is that Great Expectations was picked as a BBC Radio 2 book club choice. And I mean I've seen you now BFFs with Zoe Ball, so tell us about your experience doing that.
Well, that was, I was so blown away to be part of that. It was really amazing, and I was so excited and humbled and flattered. And it's, I really love the association that the Radio 2 Book Club has with libraries as well. So that was surreal. So I went to Wogan House, which is near the Broadcasting House in London, and recorded, just a 20-minute chat with Zoe Ball, who is the nicest person, by the way, genuinely lovely. Really love, like, as soon as I came in, she gave me a big hug and then started asking me about where I got my tattoos done, because she wanted to get tattoos sort of in a similar style and things. She was so lovely. But it's, that's been the most surreal thing, I think, is, Zoe Ball asking you to sign a copy of your, Zoe Ball asking you to sign something, you know? But that was really good. Oh, and there's just like a giant grand piano in the green room at the Wogan House for the BBC Radio, and I was like, why is there a giant piano? And my publicist had to be like, oh, this is the, they call this the piano room, that's Elton John's piano, and sometimes they'll get people to come and play music on the piano, and for that then they just draw the curtains around so that you can't see there's an espresso machine behind the piano.
So the magic was gone at that point.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. literally seen behind the curtain.
Yeah. So obviously that was an incredible experience for you, and probably one of your biggest highlights of being published. But I wondered how the kind of general publishing experience has been for you. We often hear about kind of like ups and downs and difficult moments. What do you think has been sort of challenging for you, or even surprising for you, that you weren't expecting to happen kind of in this year that you've had?
I really struggled when the book came out, which is ups and downs is right. I think there are times when you're like, this is very exciting, and then times when you feel like you should be more excited and you're not. When the book came out, it was strange for me, because the editing process for the book, and I'd sent it off and been done with it for sort of the better part of a year, do you know? So I wasn't thinking about that. I was thinking about the deadline for the sequel, which was looming, and I hadn't had a deadline on the first one. So that was a bit frightening, and I was very stressed about that. And when the book came out, I felt like I couldn't say, people were being very nice, and I felt like I couldn't sort of say, like, oh, I'm actually a bit stressed, I'm not feeling great right now, because they're all enthusiastic. So then I sort of had to pretend I was enthusiastic, and that was sort of tiring. And I felt guilty that I wasn't more enthusiastic, because, you know, people would really love to be in the position that I'm in. So it all just sort of snowballed and got a bit much, and I had a bit of a freak out about it, and I just kind of shut down a bit. And, you know, I wasn't engaging on stuff on social media. I had to ask my mum to stop sending me messages from the rest of the family, like pictures of them holding the book and stuff, because it just made me super anxious whenever I saw one. So it was like that my brain was sort of miswired, and all the stuff that was supposed to be making me, you know, energized and excited and feel good was making me feel anxious and worried and stressed. But getting the first draft of the book handed in has really helped with that. So I'm just a little bit more, you know, de-stressed, and I've been able to enjoy things a little bit more. It's surprising now that bookshops have become a place of fear in some sense to me, because I am well aware that I am not Richard Osman. I'm not going to be stocked in every bookshop in the country. By no means would I expect that I would. But every time I go into a bookshop, which I really love doing, bookshops are my happy place, you know. But I have to check every time now. And then if I'm not, it's just a little bit disappointing. If I'm not in there, you know.
You turn around and you go, I'm never coming in here again.
Yeah, how dare you? Do you know who I am? I've met Zoe Ball.
Yeah, come on. That's not the most authors have done. Do you have any advice then for, let's say, the next cohort of debuts, the 2024s, who some of them will be listening now and they're getting a bit sweaty because, you know, their time is almost here. What would your advice be to them about kind of, you know, your debut year, publishing? What would your advice be?
I would say, so three key things. First of all, don't compare yourself to anyone else. Everyone has a completely different journey. Everyone has different milestones. Some people will succeed hugely in audiobooks and not physical. Some people do amazing, you know, on ebooks. Other people will, you know, get reviews that you don't get, or you will get reviews that they don't get, and you'll get different opportunities. Like, everyone's journey is completely different, and you cannot compare yourself to anyone else, because there will always be someone doing better than you. So there's no point shifting the goalpost at all. Second would be, allow yourself to feel whatever you feel, you know, and don't there should be no expectation to be super excited about anything, or to be sad about anything, or to do things that everyone does, you know. Like, I didn't do an unboxing video for when I got sent my hardbacks, because I just didn't realize what it was. I just opened it. I got this guy turned up and I was like, oh, weird, a huge heavy box from Penguin Distribution. I wonder what this is. I just opened it and I was like, oh, well, there you go. Done that now. So I didn't get to film it and put it online and, you know, video of me crying and being emotional, you know, like. So just feel however you feel about stuff, and don't force yourself to super enjoy bits or not enjoy a bit. Just feel whatever and give yourself a break, because it's tough. And the third would be to, like, you can say no to stuff, whether that is doing an event that would be a big stress, or going on a panel that you don't feel comfortable doing for whatever reason, or if you don't like the cover design, or you don't like the idea for how the publisher is going to pitch some marketing, you can say no, and you can push back, and you can make it a conversation that you're in control of as well, because it's your book, right? So that's three pieces of advice, isn't it?
I always think as well with that, with the saying no, or the, you know, pushing back a little bit, you know, the worst thing that can happen, and, you know, there's nothing that's going to be worse than this, is that they'll go, no, you know, we're not changing our minds, or they're not going to force you to do an event, but they might, when it comes to like editorial things or marketing things or cover things, they may just say, no, author, you know nothing. But you know, they're not going to it's not going to be the end of the world, you know. It will just be, unfortunately, we've decided this. And it does happen. It happens to, I would say, probably 80-90% of authors. And you've just got to decide, you know, are you willing to have that battle? Are you just going to go, that's fine? Sometimes I think as well, it's good to come up with an alternative. Like, I remember there was something about my proofs. I wasn't 100%. Oh, that was it. I will say this publicly. On the proofs, they wanted to put the final two sentences of the book on the back cover. And ooh. I am someone who, I think that reading the last chapter of the book or the last page of the book is like the worst crime in the world. So I was like, can we not? I do not want this. Yeah. I feel like it's just wrong. You know, it upsets me. And then I just came up with an alternative couple of months. And they were like, yeah, sure, fine, we'll change it.
Yeah.
So, you know, that was it.
Yeah. And then, yeah, that is the thing. Like, if you say, can we, you know, change this? The worst thing they can say is no. But I feel personally that I feel better being part of that conversation and not just being, you know, a paper boat pushed around by the current.
Yeah,
and a final bit of advice as well is to, if you are a bit trepidatious about pushing back on things or being a bit mean or you don't want to seem difficult, get your agent to do it for you, because that's what they're there for. You pay your agent to be mean on your behalf.
Yeah, definitely. That is a great bit of advice. So finally, I know there's a sequel in the works. You've already told us. Can you give us any hints without spoiling the first book? I mean, I'm obviously a different.
Yeah.
give us a little tease.
So it's the same gang of four. So it's Claire and Sophie and Basher and Alex. And they decide after the events of the first book, they need a break. So Alex books them a holiday on a retreat on an island off the coast of Ireland that is a haunted, you know, reputedly, that's the word, isn't it? It's a haunted island where there's maybe some pirate treasure. So Alex is very keen on digging that up. But it turns out they've been double booked with another group of people, and death and hijinks ensue.
That sounds so much fun. It just sounds a brilliant setup, and what a great gang of four as well. And I'm sure anyone who's read Grave Expectations will be eager. Do you know when the next one might be out? Have they given you a kind of hint?
No, I think we would aim for the same time, but next year, so maybe May next year.
Yeah,
but, you know.
And I mean, is it possible that you might be writing another one after this?
I have ideas, but I will write them as long as they let me, but I haven't got another deal yet, but fingers crossed.
You've got ideas, which is the important part. Oh, amazing. Well, Alice, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's been so much fun.
That was Alice Bell talking about her crime novel, Grave Expectations, which is out now and available to buy. And if you'd like to support this podcast, debut authors and independent bookshops, you can now shop in the Confessions of a Debut Novelist bookshop, hosted by bookshop.org, which I've linked down below in the show notes. If you fancy buying any of the books you've heard on this podcast, then the majority of them can be found in this bookshop. And if you can, I would really appreciate you supporting me, supporting the authors and independent bookshops by buying them through this online store. Thank you so much for listening. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Or if you've subscribed already, it would be great if you could leave me a review. See you next time.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High-quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style. Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.